This podcast was created using Anchor.
Boom, 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 boom. Hum dum dum da da da. 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 It's good.
Yeah.
So good.
Okay.
Oh,
hey.
Since we're together.
Well, babe, here we are. We're back.
This is loud, huh?
It's loud. It's okay. I'm following the clipping. We're all right.
Hi, everybody.
We're back. It's been about a month, but we're back.
And we know you missed us.
That's right. That's why we're back.
Because the kids were demanding an episode. And by demanding, I mean, I don't think I received one text asking me where we were. But
well,
it's
everyone
fine.
Knew where we were. We were in Brighton Beach.
Brighton Beach.
Again,
we went to Brighton Beach, you guys.
Yeah, it was really cool because we were definitely not in a foreign country.
Definitely not.
So we just got off our Zoom interview with Alexandra Silber.
Who, oh my gosh!
This week's subject is Swirl Meets Death, and so we don't want to waste any more of your time. We want to get right into it because it's kind of, we went on for a long time, but it's all amazing.
Yeah, Al is amazing. I don't feel right calling her Al, so I'm going to do Alexandra. She's amazing. If you don't know her, she's a Broadway diva, but an author, but a speaker, but a poet, and she's just so great. And I am so honored that all these people are friends of ours.
Yeah.
And we get to have them on our show.
Yeah.
So, and they've all been so giving of their time and energy. So thank you for coming on the show. And we're just going to actually just get right to it because it's a longer piece. And we want, we feel like, you know, yesterday was May 3rd, which is my mother's birthday. I lost my mother in 2009. And so it's going to be 12 years, September 12th. And David lost his father on September 11th of 2016. So we wanted to really talk about death and loss because we don't talk about it enough. We just don't. And I find that because I've lost so many family members and now friends, that I'm one of those people that is like really good to have around if you lose someone, one of your loved ones, or even a pet. Now that I've lost a pet as well. So it's like, I'm very good to have around because I know what to say. And it's tricky to know what to say when people are going through something like that. But we kind of addressed that in our interview. And, you know, I just think it's important to have a dialogue around it because it's a part of life. It is a part of the life cycle. And
and we had a really deep conversation, but also a really fun conversation. And stick around for the game at the end of the episode, because that was super fun, too.
Yes.
For all of you music theater nerds out there. And for anybody who is just like a human being.
Yep.
We're really, really proud of this interview. So let's just get right to it. Here we go.
Enjoy.
Says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and all my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family? What if I die here? Who'll be my role model now that my role model is gone? Picked up back down the alley with some roly-poly little bat-faced girl. All along, there were incidents and accidents. There were hints and allegations. If you'd be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Daddy, and Daddy, when you call me, call me out. Call me out.
Born in Los Angeles, California, she grew up outside Detroit, Michigan. She attended Interlochen Center for the Arts and continued her training at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland in Glasgow, graduating with a degree in acting. She graduated just days before her professional and West End debut as Laura Fairley in Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Woman in White at the age of 21. Her other British stage work includes Huddle in the Sheffield Crucible's 2007 production of Fiddler on the Roof and its subsequent West End transfer, and Julie Jordan in Carousel at the Savoy Theatre in London's West End, for which she received a UK Theatre Award for Best Performance in a Musical. She returned to London at the end of 2021 to reprise her role in the Broadway transfer of Paula Vogel's Indecent, directed by Rebecca Teichman at the Menier Chocolate Theatre. In 2016, she completed a run on Broadway as Seidel in the Tony-nominated revival of Fiddler on the Roof, directed by Bart Schur, starring seven-time Tony nominee Danny Burstein as Tevye. She made her New York theater debut in 2011, portraying the young wife in the Transport Group's revival of Michael John Lacuse's Hello Again, receiving a Drama League Award, and later that year played opposite Tony Award winner Tyne Daly in Terrence McNally's Masterclass at the Kennedy Center, making her Broadway debut in the same production. She's been featured in acclaimed performances at the Vineyard Theatre, the Muni, Chicago Shakespeare Theatre, the McCarter Theatre Center, Carnegie Hall, and of course, the Invariable, many others. But she joins us today as the acclaimed author of not one, but two works, both published by Pegasus Books. First, her debut novel, After Anatevka, chronicling what happens to the characters of Huddle and Perchik, made famous by the Sholem Aleichem stories. And specifically because this is our Swirl Meets Death episode, we wanted to have her dive into the topic off the springboard of her poignant, heartbreaking, and hilarious memoir, White Hot Grief Parade, about losing her father to cancer when she was 18, which I have now just completed via her absolutely stunning performance of it on Audible.com. Please welcome to the pod, Alexandra Silber. You can call her Al.
Oh, thank you for having me. Also, dear listeners who could not see the dance party, I hope there's like behind the scenes footage, because that was that was a delight. Also, David, very like beautiful teaser introduction with music. Love. I'm so honored to be here. I'm your biggest fans, not only of your artistry, but of your relationship.
You know? Well, thank you.
Stop it! You're making me blush.
Well, you know, we try to set an example for the kids if we can. So, first question is: was that the most elaborate introduction you've ever gotten in your life? And the answer better be yes.
Yeah, I mean, there was a full production. I felt like I was being introduced. I was being hyped on Star Search. That's a throwback.
Wow! Were you on Star Search?
Never, but I remember watching it and actually feeling like that. This is like a very real thing. Speaking about survival, the survival mode and death, I remember thinking, "Wow, these are really talented people, but they also have just like audacity." Always thinking that about the people on Star Search. I was like, they just really, they're going for it. They are big and large.
There's something to learn from everywhere, isn't
there? There is. Yes, exactly.
Like we watch American Idol, you know, with a fine tooth comb, because you never know what you're going to learn.
You never know what you're going to learn. And sometimes it's like, interesting placement choices.
Right?
Or sometimes it's like, I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's like, I guess I never understood that song, and now I do, which is also fun.
That'll happen. Yeah,
we love that. Hi, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you. Thank you for being with us today.
My joy. Thank you for spending so many hours with me reading to you out loud.
It was amazing.
Oh my God. He loved your book.
Thank you.
He loved you narrating it.
Thank you.
He went on and on about how funny and charming and just like beautiful it was.
Thank you
so
much.
Well, I'm actually ashamed that I haven't.
You shouldn't be. This is what we do, babe. I prepare, you respond.
No, but you should have already read it because she's my friend. Do you know what I mean?
So first of all, thank you. This is a no shame space. But okay. Two, can we just quickly tell the listeners that when David and I started texting, Rihanna was like, just to be clear, she is my friend. Like, and I want to be like, we can all be friends, guys.
Yeah, no. I'm very possessive.
I love it.
And I cede the territory to my wife.
You don't know. He said to me, well, do you have Alex's, no, wait, you said Al.
I would have said Al, yeah. Do you have Al's number?
And I said, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, so you want me to text her or you want to do it? It's like, I will text her because I'm her friend.
Yeah, she did. I was trying to just, you know, take the labor off of her shoulders, but no, it really became a territorial issue.
Yeah. You were proud that you had her number. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to shut this right down.
Yeah.
I totally understand. I totally understand. And the other thing I just want to say is, have you ever, in previous relationships prior to your perfect marriage, yes. Have you ever like gotten a friend in the divorce? Do you know what I mean? Where you're like, that person was my ex-partner's friend, but now they're my friend.
You're going to win.
I always say that I have one particular friend that I definitely got in a divorce and where you're just like, can I keep you? Cause you're the best, you know, those are the best.
I would let, if that were to ever happen, which would never happen because I'd kill you before I'd let you divorce me. I would let you have David because he's a good man.
Oh, thanks, babe.
I also have the spiritual capacity to love you both. No matter
exactly. Yeah. A lot of people don't. A lot of people don't have that.
Well, you know, she's got the Russian Jew thing, but she's also got the Hispanic thing.
Yeah.
So it's just like she's
there's just so many feelings. My loves, thank you for having me, especially in this capacity too, because this is such an important topic to get out and bring into our lives, not just when we are at the end of those lives.
Amen. And yes. And I told you this, I haven't told our listeners, but we made a list for season two of all of the big topics. Like, that's what we're going to do. Squirrel meets career, squirrel meets food, squirrel meets love, squirrel meets sex. So obviously we had to have squirrel meets death. And we were sitting around thinking about, because the other thing we're trying to do is bring in one of our friends or one of our people to have these conversations. And so the criteria were,
we want someone who understands loss and death, but who's funny. That's what he said to me. And I was like,
hello.
Yeah. It didn't take very long.
It literally took 5 seconds at most. And I said, let's invite the woman who wrote the book, literally.
Yeah.
And that book was White Hot Grief Parade. And it's absolutely stunning. It's gorgeous and heartbreaking and deep and wise and hilarious.
And so I have
many questions, but my first question is, and this is a terrible thing to ask you, horrible.
I feel like
the Jewish mother you never had asking this question.
Great. But hit me.
When's the movie adaptation coming?
I'll be honest. I've had some good sniffs.
I'm sure.
And I'll say this about both books, actually, after Natevka as well, that I would rather wait and have them done right than just have them done and out there. I feel like they're both such sensitive and important embodied material in my imagination. And so, for example, so often with After Natevka, people are like, when's the musical? And I always want to be like, how do we compete with the original musical?
That's a tough one. I was going to write Porgy in New York. What happens after he leaves on his goat cart to
New exactly. York City?
I actually started mapping that one out and I thought, wait a minute, let me really think this through.
Totally. Exactly. Having more of a cinematic mini series vibe for After Natevka, but I also feel like there's so many sensitive and tender things that I'd want to remain really universal without being overly commercialized or have the saccharine whitewash and dilute mm-hmm. the intensity of the conversation around death. Yes. And that I think is, it's going to take I hope somebody that's really interested in telling all of the truth about not only my experience of death and grief, but of the experience of death and grief for all of us, which is extremely confrontational and yet a fire that cleanses you mm-hmm. if you are able to bear the burn.
Now, you were able to release both these books in 2018 at the same time, as I understand.
No, they were, it's so funny, they both had the same birthday, but a year apart. And they also had the same birthday as me, which Amazing. Was a complete coincidence. My publisher didn't know that. So the first, After Natevka came out in July of 17, and After Natevka came out in July of 18. Mm-hmm. And yes, I remember throwing like a little get together. Remember those get together for nice. My remember those for my birthday. And I was also like, and it's also my book's birthday. LOL. They came out a year apart.
And the process of White Hot Grief Parade, the writing of it, took place over how many years and from what age to what age?
Really interesting question. So, one of the things that I talk about often, and I love the opportunity to talk about writing and the process of writing, especially in contrast to theater and music, is that, they're inextricable from each other. That After Natevka was born, I would say in 2009, when I was doing Carousel at the Savoy. And I joke that it was sort of like, written during June Is Busting Out All Over and the Carousel Dream Ballet, but it really was, because for those of you listening who know Carousel, Julie Jordan is the loneliest track. Yeah. While everyone else is having fun, you're just preparing to cry again. and tightening your corset, preparing to cry again. But it was really a balm for me to feel creative inside a long run when the joy of performing is still there, but the daily creative burst starts to ebb. In those moments, I always talk about this with people, that when people come to performing for creative buzz, they don't realize that if they're in a very long run, that starts to ebb and wane at the 4 or 5 month mark, and you have to take charge of your own creative spark. So I would say that began very, very early in my life. And After Natevka was written really over the course of like 7 or 8 years. It was my greatest companion in every dressing room, every place I went. I remember typing it in the Kennedy Center dressing rooms and in Chicago, all these places that I went. And White Hot Grief Parade, however, was a very, very different experience. I have been blogging for years, really since 2007. I do on my blog, which is called London Still, I have some like archived posts from 2005 and 6, but it really started in earnest in 2007. And so I was used to the, here is my voice in written form format. Mm-hmm. And that was obviously much more accessible to me and much more right at the top of my brain and the surface of my skin. With After Natevka, what was different was I wasn't just writing a novel. I was writing a historical novel, and I was learning how to write a novel. So there was a really big learning curve there. And one of the things that happened, no spoilers, but like I have to just lean into a little bit of a spoiler. After Natevka is written in 3 acts. I wanted it to feel vaguely theatrical in that way. And I had completed the first and second act of the story. The first is sort of Hoddle's backstory. The second is Perchik's backstory. And then in the third act, we sort of meet them both in the present day in Siberia, and they finish their story. Mm-hmm. And I knew what I wanted to do in the third act, but I was horribly, horribly blocked. Mm. And this was right around 2011, I was doing Masterclass, the Kennedy Center production that transferred to Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I had, for those of you who know Masterclass, the Sopranos are either in one act or the other. So I was in the first act and I had the whole second act to myself, and was basically had this 45 minutes to write every day. It felt like this going to the office space, right? Mm-hmm. And 2011 was the 10-year anniversary of my dad passing away. And there were a lot of things about it that were very significant. One was, despite all this wonderful West End success, which was beautiful and exhilarating and shocking, especially in hindsight, do you guys ever look at the stuff you used to do and you're like, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, and I think, boy, at the time, if I'd only appreciated what
yeah, completely. Was going yeah. on, you know. Completely.
I found all the ways I could think of to denigrate it, but yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Or compare and despair.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The joys. So I, despite all those wonderful things, like here I was on Broadway. And if you're an American theater kid, that is sort of this Olympics-ish dream to actualize, which, you know, I don't necessarily know that I agree with, because as I've aged and matured, I've realized, you know, the theater world is the theater world and we all participate in meaningful ways. And Broadway in many ways is just geography. Mm-hmm. But despite that, there I was. And I think, and this kind of interestingly brings up a grieving point, I had found and have continued to find that as grief starts to ebb and be incorporated into one's life, it is not the tough moments where you go, oh, if only my dad were here and I could talk to him in this tough moment. It's the joyful moments where mm-hmm. you wish with all your soul they could be there, because they should be there. Mm-hmm. And this Broadway debut was one of those moments, and it was coinciding with the 10-year anniversary. And there was a part of me that was like, Dad, I did it, and not in a career sense. Like, I turned out okay. I actualized. I'm living the dreams that you gave your life for me to be able to live. And I felt that there was this very important opportunity for me to express filterless what this moment meant for me and what I'd learned in the last 10 years and who I'd become. And so I wrote a blog post called 10 Years and published it on the anniversary. And I will say that this blog post, which is still up, was just different in both my energy inside of it and the tone of the writing, right? So therefore it was received in a very different way. This was before Instagram. This was before mm-hmm. Twitter had really taken off and Facebook was young. So this, we weren't quite in the universe of like overshare and yes. unadorned.
Yeah.
So it was very raw and different. I just took that off. I took all the makeup off and I talked about not just what I learned, but what it was like to stand back up every painful day. Mm-hmm. And the next morning I woke up and my literary agent called and said, have you seen what happened to your blog post? And I was like, no. She goes, it's gone viral. It's all over the world. And I was like, oh. And I, you know, there's like that first moment of like, you know, and breathlessness and also fear that so many strangers who have not been with me on this blog journey mm-hmm. are reading this. But also what it really filled me with was, wow, we do not have this conversation. We do not talk right. about death very often. And when we do, we don't talk about it very well. And yes. there are people that are aching
yeah.
to spend time here.
Yeah.
And my agent, who's also at this point had become a very good friend, Louise, said to me, this is one, a book. And two, if you write this, you will be unblocked in After Anatevka, that there's something in here that you have not processed and faced. And I feel that if you write this, After Anatevka will finish itself. And she was right. I wrote in comparison, right?
Wow.
The bulk original manuscript of White Hot Grief Parade flew out of me in about 6 weeks.
Wow.
And it contextualized itself over time. I added things as I continued to learn when it got closer to publication, right? Mm-hmm. But the majority of the structure and the majority of what I was going to cover flew out of me. And she was right. Once I finished that about 6-8 weeks later, After Netevka finished itself.
Wow.
It was so interesting how I couldn't finish the book because I had to write White Hot Grief Parade and deal with everything inside there.
Well, I mean, that's amazing because I one among the many moments in your book and in your performance of your book that just really brought me to tears was very near the end when you begin to list all of the dreams that have come true, all of the great things that have actually happened in your life. And it goes on for a while because there's a lot of great stuff that happened in your life. And you just get to that point where you're thinking, well, this is a little bit of a humble brag coming from Alexandra Silber. And then you drop the bomb. And I would give it all away for just one thing.
Yeah.
And I lost it.
I mean, thank you. And to both of you, wouldn't you?
That is exactly where I went. And that is exactly how I felt. I felt, yeah, Dad, if my dad could be here, that would be.
Yes. I remember you both writing before your wedding, and feeling so much identification with both of your offerings about each of your parents and how you were like, I finally found this person that I wish you could love and I wish you could know. Mm-hmm. And from your wedding dress moment to, you know, these just really acknowledging that, we, you know, the three of us and so many people like us get to do extraordinary things. And I really would. I'd put it all in a beautiful box and give it away for one thing. So I thank you. I think that is also the thing that is impossible to fully understand unless you've seen there and borne witness to that absence.
Yeah.
And there, I think in a lot of ways too, it does make you grief and loss. And please, like, tell me if you agree with this, because I'm by no means the expert here, but I think it also makes those accomplishments sweeter, one. And then on the other side of it, the just right appropriate size. Would you agree with that?
Oh my God.
We
talk about this all the time. It's just
having
gone through probably one of the worst things you can ever go through, totally losing a parent or losing a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once you go through it, it contextualizes everything. And you have suddenly this huge perspective of the world and the things that happen in it. And they don't really matter once you've gone through that.
Yeah. And you both actually had similar experiences in terms of the moment in life when you lost your parent.
Totally.
In connection to where you were at the births of your careers.
Mm. Right. It also felt so, I don't know about you, but like the birth of my career felt like it was something I felt like I had to do. I had to do it to fulfill what my dad had contributed to, and my mom, who gave up so much of her time and energy and gorgeous soul to care for my dad in his final days. I felt like I had to do it not only for myself, but for them.
Yeah.
And only in arriving there and sort of going, oh my gosh, I'm here, I did it, did I acknowledge how much that loss had informed my arrival there. The real moment that I awoke to it, interestingly, was when I was doing Huddle in Fiddler, and I was like, Papa, God alone knows when we shall see each other again, in the very first read through. And I was like, God, you know, just that it hadn't even really occurred to me. And then I was like, great. I'm going to go on to do this for 2.5 years, you know?
Yeah.
And yet it was a gift. And that said though, it was 5 years after my father had died, and I had tabled the grieving experience in a lot of ways. I had cauterized the wound, right? But I hadn't healed what was going on underneath, because I just, I had to become myself. I had to grow up. I had to go to college. I had to get on with it. But one of the, again, one of the, an important thing to discuss today, I think, is that is not the same as dealing with it. That is not the same as metabolizing the grief. There's a time and a place for tabling and compartmentalizing and healthy denial, but it will find you. It will find you. You can run, but you can't hide. And I felt so cradled, if you will, that I arrived on Hoddle's doorstep and at Fiddler's doorstep, right when I felt secure enough and safe enough to truly get the goodbye I didn't get in life.
I was definitely reading the book and thinking, how on earth did you get through Far From the Home I Love 8 shows a week? How did you do it?
I actually think
talk about compartmentalizing.
I have no idea. I have no idea. Yeah, compartmentalizing, and also probably a little bit of not admirable no technique, you know, like going, you know, I sometimes teach students and I do acting through song classes, and I often want to admit, I feel like it's really important to admit that in the early days of my career, I didn't use the technique I had been gifted by Royal Conservatoire. I just picked the scabs and let them do their thing. And that isn't sustainable. And that isn't, shouldn't be revered as art, you know,
as the process.
Yes. And I think there were definitely days when the goodbye and the separation was not Hoddle at all. And I acknowledge that. And it's been a gift to be able to revisit that story over and over again. And, you know, interestingly too, speaking of like the happy moments, that I always thought, you know, it's so interesting, because when you brought up your wedding dress fitting moment about your mom and also about your stepmom, which was such a beautiful story that perhaps you can share with the listeners that don't know it. But what I got from that was there are a couple of really endemically human mythological things that we share with our parents and culture. And these life cycle moments, like weddings, really reveal themselves to be those. And the wedding dress try on with a mother is such an iconic experience, and the walking down the aisle with a father moment is another. And I remember having this experience, actually it was at Nika Lanzaroni's wedding, and she got married in I think 2014 2014. I saw her dad walking her down the aisle, and I had this Greek level response, like just absolute agony. And I didn't entirely, my brain and my spirit and my body were not communicating. And it took me a couple hours into the reception, and I was like, you know, clutching a cocktail and breathlessly coming to, realizing, my gosh, like, no matter how successful I ever become, no matter what I ever do, I can't purchase that moment. I can't replace it. And I remember thinking, interestingly, a couple years later, wow, how beautiful that Fiddler, in a way, in its beautiful way that theater does, excuse me, in a way, it gave me the goodbye that I didn't get in life. And I also got to dance with my dad at my wedding as Seidel. And it was actually worked into a little wedding dance with Danny Burstein, and I was something that Bart really gave me as a gift. And I remember he was sort of like, you can do the chairs, or you can dance with your you can dance at the wedding. You much don't get chairs. Both. Yeah. And I was like, I want the dance. But yeah, it was a really special thing. So yeah, I think those are the moments that ache the most.
Babe, do you want to talk about the wedding dress?
Yeah, please. Oh, it's such a beautiful story.
Well, the listeners, I think most listeners know, but I lost my mom in 2009, and she had congestive heart failure. This was after a whole life of dealing with heart issues, and she had had two heart transplants, one when I was born and one when I was 8. So the second heart she had been on for 16 years, which the average lifespan is 10. So, but as a kid, I didn't really realize that we were on borrowed time, and I lost her at 24. So it was kind of like, I was just out of college, you know, I was living my life. And she started to go south the summer that I was at the Kennedy Center, actually. And she didn't come out to see the show, which was not normal. And so I went back home afterward. And I said, I think we're going to go to Broadway. I think I'm going to go with it, but I have time. So I'm going to be with you. And I was making all her meals or organizing her pills because her mind was going, but I still didn't really realize what was happening. And she passed right before it was right before I left to have my debut in Ragtime. So she knew it was happening. And I remember when I told her, she cried in a way that I had never seen her cry. And I think it was because she knew she wasn't going to live to see it. And yeah, she passed, I think less than a month later. I was in New York when she went. So jump cut to 2019, 10 years later, I'm on tour with Falsettos, and I had made purposely the moment of finding a dress minute. I had said, oh, it's no big deal. I didn't plan it way in advance. I was getting married in September, but I said, oh, we'll just find it in April. You know, we'll look, there's a place I want to look at that's in LA. So I'll go while I'm on tour. And Nancy, my stepmom, and my dad had come out to see the show, and we had made this date to go at freaking 9 a.m., which is, for me, ridiculously early. And it was
she's on an 8-show-week schedule.
You understand, I never leave it. Yeah. And so I got down to downtown LA, go to this place called Coco Melody. We go in, and my stepmom is waiting. She's got a big smile on her face, and she's like, cannot wait to share this moment. And I realized I had kind of been dreading it because my mom wasn't going to be there, but I was excited because she was going to be there. And I knew that it meant so much to her to share it. I didn't realize how much it was going to mean to me. So we put on a few dresses. I found it in like 3 dresses because I make my mind up very quickly what I look good in. And I was in the dressing room putting on a shell, which is like how they size you. They're like, we have shells in size, you know, 6, 8, blah, blah, blah. So I went in, and they had music that was playing over the whole thing, because, you know, you've got the whole shop to yourself. And the song came on, Because You Love Me. And I stopped everything and I broke down crying because in high school, we had a mother-daughter luncheon every year. And one year, my mother she was like, no, you're singing at the mother-daughter luncheon this year. You get there, have a big runway. You're going to sing at it. We're going to buy a new dress. She had talent scouts there that day, talent scouts and
star search.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I sang Because You Love Me. And so it was like, and everyone remembered it from high school. It was like a really big deal that I did that. And so when that song came on, it was like, oh, she's here. And she's here to tell me that it's okay, that I'm here with my stepmom. And it was like, it just suddenly felt like approval. I felt relief. I felt like, oh, you know, you're putting your blessing on this.
Yeah.
I don't dream about my mother very much, which I hate. Yeah. I always, you know, I miss seeing her face and hearing her voice and those things. I don't have voicemails, like none of that. So it felt like she was there and she was telling me in her own way. And I shared it with my stepmom. I was like, of all the songs, Celine Dion, right? Mm-hmm. Celine Dion's Because You Love Me playing in a wedding shop is like so unexpected. And it totally caught me off guard. And then the rest of the experience was beautiful. I think I had been a little bit pent up. And as soon as I got that assurance, it was like, oh my God.
I love everything about this story. I love everything about this story. I want this to be a short story. I want this to be a short film. I love it.
If I may, as a writer, because I've made these connections, there is a connection. There's actually connections that zoom through that story among the three of us, which are in the case of Brianna losing a parent that came back to talk to her and
Rihanna's loss happening while she was on Broadway in Ragtime, yeah. and the Ragtime connection to yes. Alexandra
that
connected from her meeting a young Alexandra Silver after she was doing a performance of, anyway, Alexandra, you can make the connection from yes. the Ragtime thing and how your father showed up for you in that moment that came back. And then,
yes.
And then there's more Ragtime connection, which I'm about to make, but you do.
Oh,
you.
I love. So first of all, just Brianna, that story. And one of the things I want to say, just to observe about how beautiful that story is one, this knowledge that in terms of afterlife, like regardless of whatever spiritual things any of us adhere to, we truly don't know anything. Right. And ultimately what I have come to feel is that being open to those moments when they are comforting and when they bring meaning making to my or anyone's life is better than writing it off as coincidence. That's the lesson I've learned. And the thing about your story that is so extraordinary, and I think many listeners will identify with, I know I do, is that the gift that was given to every single woman in this story, your mother showing up in the form of the song, gave you the permission to know, I'm here. And not only am I here, but I give you permission to release all of the feelings about me not being physically mm-hmm. here for this moment. Mm-hmm. And may you open your heart mm-hmm. to let your stepmother stand in for me and give her the gift of your full attention. Mm-hmm. So that, because sometimes that one of the many things I think is true about grief and support in general, but grief especially, the things that really rile us is allowing somebody the gift of loving you and showing up for you yeah. is one of the most generous things we can do when we're broken. Mm-hmm. And that story to me encapsulates so many beautiful human themes. I love everything about it. And yeah, I think one of the things you wrote about in your post too about your stepmom was how grateful she was that she yeah. got to do that. And what a gift to all of you. So my Ragtime story. When I will say that like the 1998 Broadway season was very big in the Silber household, from the Cabaret revival to
yes.
Scarlet Pimpernel, such an underappreciated score.
Hey, go back and listen to the Doug Sills episode, you know, for a little
P.S. Doug Sills and I are from the same hometown.
Okay.
I've never actually met him, but
we can remedy that.
You guys would go.
Oh my God.
I think we'd be besties. And doesn't he run a mall, by the way? Does he run a mall?
Yeah.
In Detroit.
In Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's outrageous.
It's outrageous. I recall this, but so yes, we love the Scarlet Pimpernel. And of course the Ragtime. Yeah.
Number one.
Number one. It was,
hands down.
I don't know if you guys had it, you know, the two disc. We also had the two cassette for the car, right?
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it just like bound our family together. It was this profound, profound family bonding. And and every performance and every song, all of it. And the short version of this, I go into detail in my book, is that my dad ostensibly, through a series of unbelievable coincidences, which was very much my dad had like magic that happened to him. He won a radio contest and he won an all expense paid trip to New York City and house seats to see Ragtime on Broadway. It was beyond. And if you read the book, you'll see that it was also through another series of coincidences. Anyway, there we are in New York City. My dad wanted to be the person that took me to New York for the first time. He wanted to do all those things. And we as a family saw Ragtime and were, what is the word? Obliterated. Melting. melting yeah. in the, we were actually in this, the stage right house left box mm-hmm. melting. Yeah. And it was also the, one of the many weeks that Broadway was doing the Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS Red Buckets.
Okay.
And for those listeners that don't know, it happens twice a year. And they, BCEFA, as it's called in its acronym, collects money for many, many worthy causes and makes a huge impact. And it's a, it's just a joy to be a part of it. And my mother, I remember, purchased with a $100 bill, like a cash $100 bill, a poster that was signed by the, it was a very, very big deal for this wow. moment. And most crucially though, there were three cast members in the lobby, Alex Strange, who played the little boy, Stephen Sutcliffe, who played Mother's younger brother, and Judy Kaye, who played Emma Goldman. I think we can all agree, the role that is my destiny. And hello, David, have you ever considered writing a Emma Goldman musical? Because I'm ready. Okay,
sure.
I'm ready. Okay, great.
Right now.
Okay, I'm ready. But I will settle to start in ragtime. Anyway, those three were there. And I'm 14 years old. And I think I was doing, I had been like Our Town and The Mystery of Edwin Drood, my freshman year of high school, like incredibly visionary department, apparently. And my dad, you know, in full, like, I love my kid dad mode, just as like, you know, hi, actors, people just like us, my kid, and she's so great. And like, you know, I wanted the ground to open and eat me alive. I wanted my life to end right there in the lobby of the Forts, right? I was like, oh.
And you are how old at this point? You're about
14.
14. Yeah.
The height of embarrassment mode, right? And I was still able to appreciate like, wow, my dad is genuinely right. proud of me. But I was also like, dad, could you cool it? These are pros. Right. And yeah. Judy Kaye, I'll never forget it. Judy Kaye looks at me, gets really close and looks not at me, but into me, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. She looks into me and she goes, you will. And it went in, right? It went in. And I held it in my heart forever. And it just became this incredibly important memory for our family. Fast forward, cut to, as you said, cut to, I'm making my Carnegie Hall debut in 2013, opposite Judy Kaye.
Okay, Judy Kaye.
Yes.
Yeah, Judy Kaye. And I'm sitting on this story, right? And like, how do I tell her that like, I can't, right? And there's also just like so much going on. It was this, I don't know if you guys know or any listeners know, the Forrest and Wright musical that they did for Edvard Grieg. It's called Song of Norway. And it has this like unbearably fourth-rate book, but the music is pretty glorious. And anyway, it's like Kismet, but with Grieg.
But and, worse.
But so much worse. And yeah. Santino Fontana was playing Grieg and I was playing his wife / first cousin, Nina Hagerup, and Jason Danieli was singing B flats. And like, anyway, it was just a lot was going on. Okay.
Right.
I think Jim Dale narrated. Anyway, there was a lot going on, but there was.
It was always Jim Dale. Always. If you had a question is who's narrating, it was always.
It was always Jim Dale.
Jim Dale.
And I just quick story. I actually asked Jim Dale in rehearsal. I was like, would you record my voicemail? And he's like, no, but only because I literally get asked that at least twice a week. And I was like, okay. And he goes, not but really good. I will do anything you want from Pete's Dragon. And I was like, oh my God, will you do Passamaquoddy? And he did it for me like at 100, no marking.
That's
just
sweet.
Just very so sweet. Okay, wow. Just to be clear. So anyway, there I am. And I'm sitting on this story. And one night we're doing some promo for the production. And we're at the Pierre, which for those of you who aren't in New York City is a very fancy hotel in New York City. And I actually think that the Queen of Norway was there. We're like, we're singing for the Queen of Norway. We're singing Song of Norway for the Queen of Norway. And again, another thing that really only performers will understand is Jason Danieli, Judy Kaye, and I were all there in like black tie in the kitchen, waiting to sing. You know, this it's a very, you know, the high and low of it.
Yes.
And I noticed that Judy Kay is sitting down and feeling very, she just looked to be incredibly pensive and quite sad. And it was very out of character for her. She'd been extremely professional and go get them in rehearsal. And she was recovering also from knee surgery. So just really active and always doing her exercises. And this was a very different color on her. And I approached with sensitivity and was like, Judy, is everything all right? I just noticed a change in your energy. And she's like, oh, Al. And she just took this leap to tell me what was really going on. And she said, my dad just died. And I'm just so sad. I know he had such a long life. I know I was so lucky to have him for so long, but I'm sad. And, you know, and then she said, I really, really do understand, you know, I lost my own father, et cetera. But tell me, one of the things I always say, by the way, to people when they go, what do you say to somebody who's grieving? I always go, the tone of the ask should be like, tell me how to help you. Teach me you. Tell me about this person. Tell me about your agony and your joy, rather than drowning them in platitudes that make you feel better. Mm-hmm. Hold space for their truth. So I said, you know, tell me what's in your heart, what's on your mind. And she goes, it's the thought that every person I ever meet will never know him, mm-hmm. that every new person I meet won't know my dad. And I find that so hard. And this, I was like, this is the moment to tell her the story. This is the moment. And there we are, like crouching in the kitchen in black tie, right? Black tie. And I said, Judy, I completely understand. And I want to tell you a story. You know, I think that all the time. I remember feeling that in college. Oh my gosh, all these people I'm meeting in college aren't going to know my father, who was so instrumental and loved young people so much. And you, Judy, have met my dad. And she goes, what do you mean? And I told her the story. And there we are in the kitchen. I told her the story. And her face at the end, when I finished the story, she goes, I remember you.
Oh my God. I'm not going to make it.
Oh, but that's only act two. There's an act three.
I remember you. I remember him. Your family was so remarkable and so special. I remember you. And look, you did it. It was, there's no gift I could have been given that was more precious. And this has bonded Judy and I in a way that is unspeakable. I have no language to express the intensity of our bond because of it. And David is right. There is an act three. Cut two. I am in Fiddler on the Roof. And I'm coming out of the stage door in 2016, and I see a 14-year-old girl with her dad. And she's got these like braces that are kind of betraying her age, but she's got beautiful makeup, and mm-hmm. and they're there having this father-daughter moment in this father-daughter show, right? And I'm signing their program and we're talking a little, and I said, you know, do you guys do this a lot? And they look at each other and they go, you know, We should do it more. This was really special. And I look at her and I was like, are you an actress? And she looks at her dad and her dad's like, tell her. And she goes, well, I want to be, I hope to be. And I just felt this hand. It wasn't a song, but I felt this hand touch my shoulder and go, it's your turn. It's your turn to pass this forward. And I just was like, and I looked deep into her and I went, you will. Her name was Emma. I haven't heard from her. Emma, if you're out there, contact me. And as I'm walking down the street, as I'm walking down 52nd toward my subway, all I wanted to do was call my dad and say, I did it. I met us tonight. Mm-hmm. And I did the next best thing. I called Judy Kay. And I think the biggest proof, and I wonder if you guys agree with this, is the biggest proof, proof isn't the word, the biggest balm and the biggest education I have received is that the heartbeat stops, the life ends. The love keeps going. The relationship keeps growing and keeps becoming contextualized by the person you evolve to be. Mm. And that story to me embodies it so much that I still felt like I was in, I still feel that I'm in relationship with my father, mm-hmm. even though he's not interacting with me directly. And I find that to be one of the greatest gifts. If you're open to it, if you're willing to continue to be in that relationship and continue to give and receive love from a location you can't point to on a map. Mm. Thanks for letting me tell that story.
Well, I actually had, I had a reason to have you tell that story, which is also the connection to ragtime for me and Brianna, yeah. which is that in 2009, when her mother was dying, I was going through bankruptcy. And I end up taking a job at the Neil Simon Theater as the merchandise manager of the Neil Simon Theater. And so 8 shows a week after I'm, you know, tying up the music, the merchandise in the lobby, I'm going up to catch Brianna Marie Parham sing Till We Reach That Day, you know, and like just being incredibly intimidated by how beautiful and talented she is all the time. But we first meet in the lobby of the Neil Simon Theater of the Ragtime Revival. And then, you know, 6-7 years later, you know, we meet again for real. But I never tell that part of the story when people ask.
It involves bankruptcy.
It involves bankruptcy and me being the merchandise manager of the Neil Simon Theater.
I love it. I love it.
It's such a testament to you and your staying power and your.
Yes.
I remember meeting him and Maddie, my stepdaughter, in the lobby. Because they had bought lunch for us in between shows that day. I remember meeting him, but I was in a cloud because that whole thing, we only ran for 3 months. So like that whole time was very like, I'm just getting through. And I'm so grateful that I have this big funeral number where I get to let all of this out. Mm. And that was a gift, but I felt whenever anyone says, you know, I met you during ragtime, I'm like, oh, okay. I'm not sure where I was.
Sure. Remind me of your name.
Right.
But how wonderful that you both met. The metaphor of that, and I first of all completely agree. It involves bankruptcy. So many of us have been there. We just didn't have to declare it to the government, or have been emotionally bankrupt or spiritually bankrupt. All of it. I think the thing I love about the story though, is that you both met and you laid eyes on a person that you saw as glittering and at the top, but underneath it was suffering.
Yeah.
And you recognized her.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, and by the way, I really thought it was a beautiful production with a bunch of beautiful performances, but I never, ever missed the end of Act One.
When he brought it out a few years ago, he had old voice memos of me singing the song.
That is so crazy. Ancient crushiness. That is ancient.
Sorry.
Right?
I love that so much. I love it so much. It's just and I think these are the stories that tell themselves, don't they? They just there's no need to contextualize. There's no need to say this is what it's about. Mm-hmm. It speaks to something so universally human.
Well, I hope that, because you talk in your book about visitations. I never had visitations from my dad, you know, but I think that there is something about however the universe is constructed that, you know, we can take comfort in, you know, some measure of those events always seeming to happen. There's that whether they are coincidence or not, we can take comfort in the assurance that there will be those moments and we'll have them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we are meaning making creatures, human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're all storytellers, aren't we?
Yeah. And I've been talking about this a lot during the pandemic about how meaning making is one of the things that separates us from our animal cousins on earth. Mm-hmm. And some of us search for that in science and some in religion and some in psychoanalyzing. And many of us in art, even if it's not conscious, we all watch television, we all listen to music, you know, we all read mm-hmm. books, and that meaning making is there.
You have this incredible section in the book where you talk about where are memories stored.
Yeah.
And yeah. The first kiss, the first bite of chocolate, like where do those memories go? And if we don't have our memories, and I think about this so much in terms of our history, if we don't have our history and attach significance to our memories or history, then who are we?
Right. Right. I mean, exactly. I thought
that was so profound.
Thank you. I'm honored too that you spent time with me reading it to you. It was a really interesting process reading that book.
Oh, it's going to ask you, this is one of my questions.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
What was the hardest thing you've ever done? And why was it performing your father's final breaths on your audiobook?
Yeah. So first of all, I love the people at Audible so much. Absolutely amazing group of people there. And the team and the producers that worked with me on After Anatevka, which was a totally different project, a million accents, four languages, you know, a lot going on.
Yeah.
I really wanted to work with them again because I felt really safe with them. And wonderful group of people that I think you'd agree, David, made it seem like a enhanced, there were moments Absolutely. Where it felt like an audio play, and there Absolutely. Were moments that felt like a podcast, and that, you know, Absolutely. I wanted it to feel as one of the things about the book, and I think parallels my experience of grief itself, is it genre switches a lot. That I decided I was going to write a book about my grief. I wasn't going to make I didn't have a conventional experience, and every day I'd wake up and I'm like, oh, today I'm in a comedy, and today I'm in a tragedy, and today I'm in a very strange screenplay, and today I'm, and I just decided to write it in the way that felt the most accurate.
Yeah.
There are scenes that are screenplays where I really, you know, I describe my father's funeral reception in a screenplay format where I, as the narrator, are really communicating through the stage directions, a lot mm-hmm. like Tennessee Williams or mm-hmm. Ionesco. And it's because I felt like I was just watching mm-hmm. and taking mm-hmm. it in rather than experiencing it.
Yeah.
So you're also playing probably what ends up being about a dozen characters.
Yeah.
At least.
Yes.
Brilliantly. Brilliantly.
Yeah.
Your Lily is hilarious.
So. Oh, thank you. Yeah, Lily is still my best friend. And actually, Lily, my best friend, who's an oboe player, did play the oboe in, there's a beautiful section where she plays exactly what she played at the funeral. It's beautifully beautiful.
This is where the movie is, by the way, these characters. But anyway, I digress. Please continue.
And then there are other sections where I describe it more in prose, which feels a little more embodied. And then there are sections where I actually use haiku, some of which is very cutting and blackly comic, some of which is incredibly stark. And I didn't analyze it at the time, but I look back on it and I realize that the haiku is generally about death itself, and that I can only bear to speak of it in 17 syllables. Mm. It's too exquisitely painful. It's too chandeliering mm-hmm. to
we love the haikus
talk about it. Thank you. To talk about it in too much depth, but the recording. So I wanted it to feel chaotic. I wanted it to feel all over the place, but I wanted it to feel like it was all coming from the experience and mind of one person, me, so that you could trust that your narrator. That was another thing, by the way, that over time, the protagonist, if you will, which is an 18-year-old Al. I realized that when people were reading the manuscript, they felt uneasy that this 18-year-old wasn't going to turn out okay. Right. And so as time went on, by the time I published it, I guess I was 34 and had reached acceptance and had actualized and had turned out okay. And I realized that the five sections of the book needed to be rooted in 34-year-old Al going, I remember a thing that, you know, here I am inside my adult self, and I'm going to tell you about our protagonist, 18-year-old Al.
Yeah.
But what it did was it created a calm for the listener reader to go, she turns out okay because she's narrating this book, right?
Yeah. Right.
And and that was a very interesting lesson. But to answer your question you asked 6 minutes ago, because I talked too much, what was it like to record the book? So, two things. One was, it was very important to me that the reading felt appropriately embodied in the moments that were the most confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two that were pretty overwhelming. As you just quoted, yes, David, there was a moment in my life, I kind of can't believe it, where the night my father died, I felt, I had a very strange experience where I really thought I was going to have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I realize now it was probably a panic attack.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, oh my God, I couldn't breathe. My heart was, I was feeling the pain, the left arm pain. I was really not well. And I had to crawl up the stairs to my parents' bedroom. And I was going to tell them, I think I have to go to the hospital. Something's wrong. And the second I got to the door, which was closed, it all went away. And I listened to my father die through the door. I heard him gasping for air and telling my mother he loved her. And I spent that moment with them outside the door. And it was so visceral a memory for me, and also so ugly and beautiful at the same time. I had never been exposed, why would I have been, to so much, to the horror and the unpeacefulness of death.
Mm-hmm.
And we use this phrase, passing away.
Mm.
Who do we use that phrase for? Do we use it for ourselves? Do we use it for others? Because my dad did not pass away, he died. And I felt it was so important for me to truly embody as an actor what I had heard. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the only moments in that audiobook where I asked Bruce, my producer, do you think it would be appropriate for the narrator of this book to become the characters rather than insinuate them the way we do in traditional audiobooks?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I think this is a perfect exception. And I remember doing it and saying, okay, I need a break. And I went to my dressing room. And interestingly, I had just started dating my now husband at the time, Alec, bless him. And one of the things that Alec talks about a lot, there's my high school, who became my college boyfriend too, Kent, is the character in the book who is really there, this also 18-year-old kid who is doing the best he can, and it's pretty damn good. He was listening to my love of Kent as 18-year-old me. And I said, you know, do you feel any envy or, you know, jealousy that that you were robbed of those experiences? He goes, no, Kent, I'm grateful to him.
That's exactly what I would have said.
Yeah. He took care of you before I could.
And that's exactly where I was going in my brain. Like, if it had been me and Brianna, I would have said, no, I'm grateful.
Yeah, of course. And of course, that's who you're, that's your heart. That's completely your heart. And then he said, this was after he had just, I mean, I lost it, and he held me, and we had this incredibly intimate moment. And he goes, and now, just now, Al, just now, I was there. Mm. I was there. I watched you relive it. And one of the things that was so fascinating about the book was, and I sometimes wonder if you two have ever had experiences like this. This is so foreign for me as a writer performer, right? I so rarely tell the story of what happened the night I listened to my dad die. Mm. And I'd written it and I'd read it over and over and over again with my eyeballs. I've never until that day uttered it. Mm-hmm. That was the first day I ever said the words out loud, ever. And that, what I was not prepared for that. I was not prepared to have to vocally bear witness again, to embody. It was a staggering experience. And I think it speaks to the power of language and naming our condition. There are some things that cannot be uttered, maybe should not be uttered. They are too deep for language. But on the other side of that argument is sometimes linguistically uttering something, naming something, is the most powerful and freedom granting gift of humanity. And it was, it was exactly that moment. I'm sure you heard it.
Well, and, I felt it. And I actually, interestingly, I haven't connected it to the experience of listening to my father's death rattle, which was, I guess, the one story I'll tell about, you know, my father's death. And I hadn't thought about it until you were just talking just now, because really what I think about when I think of my father's death is this concept first that I experienced along with the, you know, enormous grief and, you know, longing for more. I experienced a huge sense of freedom and release, that from this moment on, it's really for me now. It's really all about me now. And, you know, I'd written a song years ago called The Old Man's Shoes, you know, which really addresses, like, you know, if I could only fill the old man's shoes, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. But this was really, now I'm free now. I'm free, as great as things were. Mm-hmm. But what I remember, and of course I lost my father about 6 years ago, so much later in life than you. So we had a trajectory from very bad in my childhood to working very, very hard to make it very good. So I'm really fortunate that that was the journey with my father. So that at the end, we were really as close as a father and son could be, you know, with the son in his early 50s and the father approaching 80. Yeah. The night he finally died, Brianna was with me, and he had met Brianna, and he had only met her on his deathbed. And when he saw her, and he had very few good moments left, you know, he said, "You're so beautiful. You're so beautiful." And then she hugged him. And as she's hugging him, my father says, "You better marry my son." Now, we've been together, you understand, what, 4 months at that point? About eight months we've been together.
Yeah.
So it was real, real early. Of course, I was, you know, that's right, Dad. Over the next 2 days in hospital, my brother showed up. And then my sister showed up. My brother's from his first marriage. I'm from his second marriage, and my sister is from his third marriage.
You don't want to leave anyone out.
There were three other wives.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other play. But he ended up well with all of them.
Mm.
And that was also the trip where my future wife met my daughter for the first time.
Oh.
All in that same.
Which
trip.
Was incredible. That trip was anointed. It actually.
Yeah, I love that phrase, by the way, and how beautiful that deathbeds can do that.
And it really it stripped away everything insignificant mm-hmm. from, and it brought us together as a family in a way we'd never been brought together. And we, the three of us, gone to get a bite to eat outside of the hospital, and that was the first time I watched my love and my daughter connect and bond like sisters. I mean, just immediately, it was the most gratifying, joyful moment, all really because my father was, you know, releasing us to the rest of our lives and to love each other. And we came back to the hospital, and I walked in to the room, and my sister had arrived very late. He was almost gone when she arrived. But she was in the room, and his wife, my wonderful stepmother, Pam, was in the room. But the sound when I walked in to the room after that mm-hmm. was something that I had never heard before. And the rattling volume of which made me physically hunt for where the speaker in the room was so that I could shut the speaker off because it was too upsetting. The sound of his breathing. Now, he was a very big man. He was 6'2". He had a huge chest. And the rattle that was coming out of this man's body was so otherworldly mm-hmm. and almost violent. So what you're saying about we don't pass away, we die. Mm-hmm. Yes, my father was dying, but mm-hmm. he was holding on. He was holding on. And my stepmother was stricken with grief and horror. My sister was, yeah. So I said, can I have the room alone, please? And they all left, all of the technicians, all of the doctors, all of the nurses, everyone's gone, just me and my father. And I went over to him, and he has cancer of the stomach, and he had several things going on at once that were, conspiring to just take him down. Mm-hmm. And so he had not been conscious or speaking for at least, a good 12 hours. It was over. My sister had gotten a few words in, but he hadn't really been able to respond. And so now we're alone, and I take my father's hand, and he's not responding to anything. He's just breathing this horrifying sound. And I say, hey, it's me. You won. Everyone came back. If there was anything to forgive from any of us, it's forgiven. They all love you. It's really okay. You can let go. Ugh. And a tear rolled out of the side of his face. And that breathing started to subside slowly, slowly. And I thought, oh, fuck, I did too good a job. He took me too seriously. Wait. So I went and I got my sister. She came back in, and my sister had her last moments with him. But basically, by the time my sister got in the room, he'd stopped breathing and it was over.
Yeah. What a gift you gave him.
Well, he gave a gift to me.
Yeah. I think there's a poem by Carl Sandburg that I love called If You Hate a Man. And it speaks to this beautiful phenomenon you've talked about with your father and the trajectory of your relationship. And one of the things I love about being alive is that we are in charge of the energy and the mythology and the lens that we put on our relationships. And there's always the potential for people to evolve and grow. It's never over. And this, do you mind if I recite this poem?
Please.
If you hate a man, let him live. You may live to see him suffer. He may live to see you suffer. Or in the slow sliding away of time, you might just forget each other. If you hate a man and you kill him at the exact same moment that he kills you, then the score is nothing to nothing. When death comes, one little room can hold the big dome of the sky, and the ocean looks easy to wade in. That's it. And I love it. I love it, that poem, because it is so true. I feel like I've been in that room holding the big dome of the sky. And all those life grudges and aches and pettinesses do fall away, don't they? If we're big enough to see to them.
Well, thank you for that poem. That would be normally the spot in the show where Brianna would say,
and scene.
But
and
we're going to take a break.
You can edit scene.
I could, but we're going to take a break. And if you've got, do you have 5 more minutes? Because we want to play a game.
Of course.
We'll be right back with a game.
Boom, 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 hum, dum, dum, da, da, dum, hum, dum, dum, da, da, dum, hum, dum, dum, da, da, dum, hum, dum,
dum. And we're back. All right, so Alexandra Silver is with us.
Yeah,
it's been amazing. But you know, we went through death and everything, and now I just think we need a little pick me up.
Yeah.
So, but it's still connected to everything we talked about before.
Great.
Now, nobody knows what this is, by the way. Brianna has no idea what I'm about to do, and I have no idea if it's going to go well or not. And the rules are pretty much, I'm making them up as I go along.
Great. I love that.
Okay. We talked a lot about a few things. We talked a lot about, you know, death and music theater and being nerds. And mm-hmm. I think they're all connected to each other. So I've put them all together into a game.
Oh my God. Okay. I am ready.
That we call, you say you love ragtime, I'll give you ragtime. Here's how it works. Here's how
it works. Oh my gosh. This is my destiny. Or shall I say, I've been waiting for you.
I'm going to give a question to Alexandra, our guest, contestant.
Okay.
And she's going to try and guess the answer to the question. The questions will run the gamut from creative questions to process questions to production questions to historical questions.
Okay.
And we'll see how we do at the end. Alexandra, are you ready to begin the game?
I'm so ready.
Fill in the blank. In 1902, Father built a house at the blank of the Broadview Avenue Hill in New Rochelle, New York.
Crest!
That is correct. Number two. Name one non-fictional character each who appears in the musical from the Immigration Group, the Black Group, and the White Group.
Immigration Group. Emma Goldman, My Destiny.
That is correct.
Of course.
White Group, Admiral Perry.
Very good.
And surprise. And the Black Group, Booker T. Washington.
You are correct.
Yeah! I feel like Admiral Perry was like niche.
Very niche. I like very that word niche. On that.
We also would have accepted Booker T. Washington, Henry Ford, Harry Houdini, Evelyn Nesbitt, Stanford White, or Harry Thaw.
Oh, Harry K. Thaw is my favorite.
Very good.
Nerd.
Number three.
Yeah.
After not saying two verses worth of things he wanted to say, what does he ultimately say?
I know how to blow things up.
That is correct.
Guys, I feel like this is my Jeopardy category. Like, I am.
Yeah, this is it.
Before settling on the Evelyn Nesbitt and Harry Houdini characters into the Atlantic City sequence in Act Two, lyricist-composer team Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty wrote two separate duets for them that were recorded, released, and ultimately discarded. Name just one of them.
Not Atlantic City. Hold on, I know this answer. Oh my God, I don't know.
We would have accepted The Showbiz.
Yeah.
Oh.
Or I Have a Feeling. You are incorrect. Yes.
I am incorrect. I failed you, Evelyn Nesbitt. And I don't know. I did not know that answer. Okay, it's all right. It's all right.
It's all right. It's all right. You're coming back.
I'm coming back.
Who were the directors of both the original Broadway production and the 2009 Broadway revival?
The 2009 Broadway revival was directed and choreographed, I believe, by Marsha Milgram Dodge.
Correct.
And the original The original production, are we talking about Toronto? Or are we talking about the Broadway? All of the above?
All of the above.
Frank Galati.
Correct. She's back.
Yes, queen.
The original.
I just want to say that I dropped like a little extra knowledge to make up for my.
Okay, sure. Well, we'll factor that in.
I flexed. Okay.
Number six, the original production of Ragtime opened in Toronto with its legendary cast that would open it on Broadway more than a year later. Canadian producer Garth Drabinsky thought he knew better than everybody else and in a truly pre-Trumpian move decided to say screw New York in 1996 and took the show to the Schubert Theater in Los Angeles instead with a completely new cast, with the exception of whom?
This is actually a guess. Is it Peter Friedman?
That is incorrect.
Ah!
The correct answer is Brian Stokes Mitchell.
The Stokes. A strong choice.
Number seven, if Garth had gone straight to Broadway when everyone wanted him to, his competition for best musical that year would have been Steel Pier, A Life, and that year's winner, Titanic the Musical. Instead, when he finally decided to open the show on Broadway in 1997, it lost the Best Musical Tony Award to what musical?
The Lion King.
That is correct.
It was so, and I know they won Best Score, and I know there was that... It was a very tough year. I mean, it was a very tough year. The best actor category that year was Alan Cumming, Stokes, Peter Friedman, and Doug Sills. Come on.
Yeah, that's right.
It was tough. Number eight, of these five celebrated artists, which one did not win the Tony Award for Ragtime? Terrence McNally, Stephen Flaherty, Lynn Ahrens, Audra McDonald, or Brian Stokes Mitchell?
Brian Stokes Mitchell did not win.
That is correct. You are correct.
Yes, queen.
Once again. Number nine. Judy Kaye's performance as Emma Goldman in the original Broadway company clearly struck a nerve with audiences and Alexandra alike. But who performed the role in the Songs from Ragtime album that predated the original Broadway cast recording?
Wait, no. I got this.
Really?
I don't got this.
Brianna, would you like to take a stab at this?
I don't have this.
The answer is Camille Saviola.
Yes, Camille Saviola, and we feel so bad for her.
Yeah.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, well, she's a legend.
Okay.
She is a legend.
Go look up Nine, the musical.
Very, very, she sings Be Italian, right?
I don't think she does sing Be Italian. Does she sing Be Italian? Why does that not seem right? No, that's not right. She does not sing Be Italian. Alexandra is doing a quick.
We can't leave this like this.
No, you're right. You're right. Are you doing the Google?
I'm doing the Google.
We can't leave this like this.
No, we can't.
You know what? And I should have known this. I just know it wasn't. It was not the Italian that she sang.
Musical numbers.
I think her name is Serafina, who sings the Italian.
The Germans at the Spa.
I was going to say it, but it didn't seem right. But that was Camille Saviola.
Okay. Our nerddom is just a little needs a
the charts a little bit.
Needs a spin class. Okay. I'm ready. I'm back.
Number 10. This is the final question.
Okay.
The legendary Act One finale, Till We Reach That Day, was first sung by Mary Bond Davis on the Songs from Ragtime album, and then by Vanessa Townsell Crisp in the 1997 original Broadway production. But who stopped the show with that song in the 2009 Broadway revival, Alexandra?
That's right, my friend, your wife will be out of poem, yeah!
And that was You Say You Love Ragtime, I'll Give You Ragtime. Alexandra, you've won the game.
Thank you. Even though I got two questions, I really it was a really majority,
yeah.
I think.
You won the game.
Strong A minus.
You won the game. You won the game. Congratulations.
Strong A minus.
Wow. You do know Ragtime.
Thank you. I don't think I know anything as deeply as this, as other than Murder, She Wrote. That's probably where I would really soar.
I can't come up with a game for you on Murder, She Wrote. So that was it. Well, Alexandra, I hope you enjoyed the game. The prize for winning the game is the same as the prize for losing the game, which is that you and Alec have to come and have dinner with us. And that's really
Total joy. I have a feeling that our double dates are gonna be epic.
They are.
I can't wait to meet this child.
Isn't he?
This is off the record.
26.
So you robbed is the it really? You really robbed the cradle, didn't you?
I did. And I, in all seriousness, when we first started dating, I was like, LOL, should we use my AARP discount? And full on, he was like, are you done? I know how old you are. So once you're over it, I'm ready to go on a date.
Oh, baby.
It's kind of like us in reverse, babe.
It is. It actually is.
Kind of like us in reverse. The only difference is that Alexandra has taken the vaccination that reverses aging, and that's really.
This is upsetting, and your mama got it too, and this is annoying.
You've seen the pictures of my mother, right? Oh no, I know you've met her, but like, can you believe?
No, it doesn't.
72. I know. So we are a micro generation apart. But it doesn't feel it.
No.
So that's what we're going to do, okay?
Okay, done. You guys, this was such a joy.
Alexandra Silver.
We laughed, we cried, we saw cats.
We did it all.
And you can call me Al, although I really liked hearing Alexandra over and over again. It's really
nice. I'm very formal that way.
Would you rather, if you're going to do Alexandra, is that okay?
Oh, I love it. I'm fine with Alexandra. If you're willing to do the four syllables, go for it.
It's so beautiful.
It is beautiful. If you're in the mood though for an abreves, I'm not an Alex.
And babe, when you read the book, you will never forget it. And my purpose in that elaborate introduction was just so that whoever listens to this podcast will never forget.
Call you Alex.
Never forget.
Thank you. I'm not an Alexist, just to be clear. I have a lot of
great
it's
Alexes.
Just not yeah they're it's great just not
you that's a different girl.
There are great Alexes who are male, there are great Alexes who are female. You're just not either of those.
I'm sure there are now some non-binary, gender non-conforming Alexes. What a wonderful name for that population. It's just deeply not
you know my feeling.
I know. You guys, thank you so much for this wonderful. I woke up feeling a little damp. And you have I don't know, I feel like it's just a pandemic thing. Some days you're like, right? Yeah. And you have lifted my soul. Thank you.
Well, you've done the same for us.
Same for us. I'm so happy. I'm so happy. This is the best.
Okay, so we'll make our date, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're here. We're fully vaxxed.
Love you.
And ready to party.
Yeah, same. So.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Yay. Great. All right. Everybody get
on. It's on.
We love you.
Okay. Love you both.
Love you.
Thank you for everything.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
The Swirl with Bree and Dave was created using Anchor, and you can find us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Don't forget to go there and rate, review,
go ahead,
and subscribe.
Well, it's good. If you'd like to follow us on social media, I'm Brianna Marie, and he's Dave Lyric.
Music for this podcast was written by Bo Black.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time on
The Swirl.